Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to share a free resource that could help you or someone you know wrestle with one of life's biggest questions. Does it make sense to believe in God? This compelling chapter from Why You Can Believe takes on today's top scientific and philosophical objections and reveals three clear reasons why belief in God is entirely rational. Whether you're exploring faith or equipping someone else, it's a must read. And it can be yours today for free. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to share a free resource that could help you or someone you know wrestle with one of life's biggest questions. Does it make sense to believe in God? This compelling chapter from Why You Can Believe takes on today's top scientific and philosophical objections and reveals three clear reasons why belief in God is entirely rational. Whether you're exploring faith or equipping someone else, it's a must read. And it can be yours today for free. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon and welcome along. It's another edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, here on Premier Christian Radio, part of your diet of thought-provoking programming on Faith Explored. So I do hope you enjoy today's show. Going to be introducing you to my guest in just a moment's time. We're asking today on the show, is the atheist my neighbour? But we'll be having some of your feedback later on in today's programme to last week's show. And that was a very sparky interchange between two guests on the future of China. So we'll get to some of that a bit later on. Later still, if you're listening between 4 and 5, you can hear the profile today. And I'll be speaking to Eric Delve. He's an author, a church leader, now an itinerant evangelist in his retirement. And he's got an amazing story to tell. So do listen out for that between 4 and 5 this Saturday afternoon. And don't forget that you can find all of the programmes from Unbelievable and related features, articles, videos and much more available from the webpage of the show. That's at premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable, and of course the ways to get in touch and find us on Facebook and Twitter from there as well. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Right now it's time to get into today's discussion. You're unbelievable. Well, today on the programme we're asking, is the atheist my neighbour, or how can Christians and atheists get along better, basically? And that's the subject of Randall Rouse's latest book. He's a Christian theologian and writer based out in Alberta, Canada, and joining me on the programme today to talk about his new book, Is the Atheist My Neighbour? And wanting to challenge a popular notion among many Christians that atheists hate God and are in rebellion at some level, and suggesting some ways forward to understand each other better. My other guest today is an atheist. He is Alom Shaha. He's the writer of the Young Atheist's Handbook. Came on a couple of years ago to talk about that with Tom Price. He's here to discuss with Randall ways in which Christians and atheists can get along better without ignoring the fact that they have very different conceptions of the world we live in. And I'll make sure to give you the links to both their respective websites on the programme today. Hope you enjoy it. Well, a very warm welcome both to Randall and to Alom today. Great to have you both with me, gentlemen. Before we come to you, Alom, I'll just introduce Randall. You're here to talk about a new book. Randall, you seem to produce about 2 books a year, as far as I can tell. I can't keep up, but tell me what sparked the latest one exactly?
I guess, how about an example of a personal experience? A few years ago, I was going to be debating an atheist. And it was going to be in a church. Mm. And so I remember telling people, yeah, I'm going to be having this conversation and debate with an atheist. And Christians, when I would tell them this, the first look in their face would be kind of revulsion or nervousness or in some cases even sort of horror. And it began to really hammer home to me the extent to which there is general distrust of atheists and a very negative attitude toward atheists among many Christians, and that really began to underscore for me the importance of exploring this theme more and understanding how Christians actually view atheists and whether it's justified the way that they view atheists.
I mean, you're no stranger at all, as you say, to debating atheists. Most of your writings have centered around interacting with atheist ideas and so on. So at one level, you might think, oh, well, Randall's the perfect example of someone who doesn't get on with atheists because he's always, interacting, arguing, criticising and so on. But that's not the way you see it, as far as I see. What you're trying to do in the book is say we don't have to agree in order to be able to still see each other as neighbours, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, as I began to look at it, I mean, I identified what I called the rebellion thesis, which sort of seemed to be simmering just beneath the surface of a lot of these initial reactions toward that exchange I was having. And as I define the rebellion thesis, it's the idea that atheists are really, at some level, they know God exists, and they're suppressing that belief in God so that they can sin. And so I actually went back into the last 300 years looking at several examples, which I note in the book, of Christian theologians, pastors, philosophers, who all sort of express this view of atheists and how even today it's a very common view. I mean, I begin the book with John Hagee, who is a very well-known Texas preacher in the United States. He's got a church of 20,000 people. And there are clips on YouTube of him preaching to his church, and he will say things like, "Atheists are brain dead," and then everybody applauds in this church. And this is a mainstream character. I mean, he appears on CNN, you know, as a spokesperson for Christianity. So when you begin to look at it, you begin to realize there are some pretty deeply seated negative views toward atheists.
Now, I hope at some level this show dispels that to some degree, because we aim to have honest and open conversations. And anyone who, you know, has, when we have someone like Alom on, it's evident that atheists have very often thought very deeply about the issues around God and haven't been able to come to a belief in God. But I know where you're coming from here, Randall, with what you've encountered, because to give it its technical term, presuppositional apologetics and theology tends to take the view that anyone who doesn't believe in God is, as you say, suppressing what they actually know deep down in their heart is true. But you find that particular sort of, if you like, brand of theology unhelpful, untrue at some level?
Yeah, it's. I think what can often be at work here is a confirmation bias. So we begin with an assumption about the beliefs and attitudes of a person, for example, and then we look for evidence to confirm that, and we carefully note that, and whenever there's evidence against it, we kind of ignore that. So, for example, we'll look to things Richard Dawkins says, which are very provocative, and we'll say, yeah, check, this all supports this idea that atheists are in rebellion, they're very angry against God, and they say incendiary things. And then someone like Alom comes along and expresses quite a courteous and thoughtful engagement with theists and a good defense of his own views, and we sort of bypass that and we say, well, he's really suppressing his anger. And so you can just perpetuate these ideas. But I think we need to begin with a principle of testimony, that, which is a term from philosophy, that says, unless you have a really good reason not to trust where people are coming from, then accept their testimony at face value. So if Alom says he just doesn't find evidence of God in the world, and he doesn't seem to have a lot of anger, I can't see it myself, he'd prefer that there be a God, then I think that all disconfirms this rebellion thesis, and we really need to set aside these kinds of assumptions and just engage with people more honestly.
Well, Alom, if anyone didn't fit the description of an angry atheist, I think it would be you. You're a very chilled out guy, as far as I can see. But you did feel, you know, you had enough reason to sit down and write a book for atheists about atheism and belief a couple of years ago, The Young Atheist Handbook. Just remind us briefly of the journey that took you to writing that book and what it meant for you.
I really wrote that book following lots of conversations with the young people I teach. So I'm a physics teacher by profession, and often the subject of God, your listeners might be surprised, comes up in science lessons, for example, when we're talking about the Big Bang or the theory of evolution. And I wanted to write a book for young people that would allow them to make sense of the world without the need for a God. But it wasn't a proselytizing book, and I think anyone who reads it hopefully will get to the message at the end, which is, I think we owe it to ourselves. We have an epistemic duty to question why we believe what we believe about the world. And that's really the message of the book, not that one should be an atheist or not.
You were raised yourself in a Muslim tradition.
Absolutely. So I haven't debated any Christians, but I have been approached by Muslims to have the God debate. And actually, unlike Randall, I don't take part in such debates because I think they're futile. And I think often they're set up to be confrontational.
Indeed.
And my encounters with Christians since writing the book and before have never been confrontational. They've mostly been about dialogue and discourse, which I think is always much more productive. And I think organisations like, for example, the Three Faiths Forum, which do interfaith work, and I've worked with them, have encouraged this mode of engagement, which I think is far more fruitful.
The only problem is, of course, and my show is a true example of it, people like, when it comes to the media, a bit of a clash, a sort of some drama.
Absolutely.
You know, and I tend to get more emails, I'll be honest, about the shows where people have clashed in a kind of fairly, you know, dramatic way than where everyone's getting on lovely and it's all, you know, cups of tea and slices of cake all round. But for you, there's a kind of a limit to which that's helpful in the end, the kind of vociferous engagements.
So I've worked in television and in the media, and I know that conflict sells.
Yeah.
However, I'm not sure that conflict is useful beyond being of entertainment value. And I think, you know, we owe it to ourselves to grow out of this kind of conflict-driven discourse and to have more sophisticated conversations.
Yeah. Well, we aim for those too on the show. But, it's great to have you on. And you were saying off air, actually, before we came in, that the first time you came in, and that was to talk about the Young Atheist Handbook, you were in with Tom Price from the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics. And you've actually remained friends with him, as I understand it.
That's right. We got on very well when we met at the station. And we've since had dinner and stayed in touch via email and Twitter. And he and I disagree about God, obviously. Mm-hmm. And you'll often find us kind of having an argument on Twitter or whatever. But it's always polite and respectful.
Right.
And, you know, I ultimately don't believe the things that Tom believes. However, that doesn't prevent us from liking each other as human beings.
Yeah, because obviously personality comes into it as well. I can imagine quite a few atheists and Christians who believe completely different things but actually get on quite well because they sort of actually enjoy the sort of the to and fro, and it's done in a way that's not nasty, but is actually sort of they find quite stimulating.
It's weird. I think for some people, and I think they're a minority, belief in God is the most important thing to them, or non-belief in God is the most important thing, the central thing that defines them as a person. However, I think for most of us, including religious people, it's one aspect of our identity, but there are other things that matter to us, our values, for example, whether we believe in equality of gender and how we feel about poor people and things like that. And those are things that are equally important to me. And, for example, Tom and I agree on those things about how society should be run and so forth. And humans, atheists and theists, can bond over those matters.
Yes, there's a lot more. There's a lot of stuff that can join us in that sense. Well, we're going to get into this discussion, though, maybe talking about some of the experiences you've both had in your encounters and discussions with people who share different opinions to you, as we open up this topic of, is the atheist my neighbour? How can Christians and atheists get along better? My guests are Randall Rouser. If you want more about him, randallrouser.com, R-A-U-S-E-R, for his surname. And he's the writer of this book, Is the Atheist My Neighbour?, available now. Links from the show, of course, to that. Our atheist guest is Alom Shaha, author of the Young Atheist Handbook. And again, another very easy website to remember because it's his name with a .com after it, alomshaha.com. Links to both of my guests and their books from the Unbelievable webpage, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook and all the other means. And I hope you enjoy our conversation today.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So as we continue to talk about this, Randall, so when it comes to the sorts of things that happen, I often find there is a big divide between what happens face to face with two people and what happens on the internet. I see this all the time, actually, here on Unbelievable. You get two people in a studio face to face. They have quite a different kind of interaction very often, a lot more perhaps understanding, less willing to sort of put the boot in, as it were, than you often find online, especially in debate forums on Facebook and so on, where temperatures can quickly rise, let's say. And that's true of the Unbelievable Facebook group, which I try to administer. I should point out for people who aren't familiar that there's a Facebook page for the show, and that tends to be just where I post what's happening on the show, interesting stories, that kind of thing. But then there's a group, and that's more for debate and dialogue and discussion. And that can get pretty heated. And I often have to step in and warn people on both sides when they're sort of, getting too heated or bullying or, making insults and so on. So what's your experience yourself on that front, Randall? Do you find that the internet has this habit, I don't know, of creating greater tensions than if we actually sat down together to talk?
Yeah, I think it's a real hazard of online forums, blogs, and so on, that we end up saying things, typing in haste, and you don't have a person sitting in front of you, and yeah, it can quickly escalate. And for one thing, you don't get the body language when you're interacting with people, so you don't always know how to read something, and it can quickly go off the rails.
Have you ever been guilty of it yourself, Randall?
Very frequently, to be honest. It often goes sideways, and it's a real discipline to try to realize when you simply have to disengage when this is not going well. You have to learn people who are interested in having a back and forth and those who aren't. So that you don't get sucked down that whole rabbit hole. And you just have to exercise a lot of caution, because you put it out there, and then it's out there. A few years ago, for example, I had an exchange with an atheist philosopher named Keith Parsons, who's quite well known. He's debated Bill Craig, for example. And he made a very dismissive comment of me at a blog, The Secular Outpost. And then I responded by blasting him on my my blog, because that's just what I do. And then he emailed me to apologize for his interaction with me, because a fellow friend of mine who's an atheist, actually Jeffrey Lauder, who I interview in my book, this new one, he sort of said to Keith, you sort of misunderstood Randall or whatever, you should apologize. Well, so here's the atheist being the one extending the olive branch, and the Christian, who didn't behave any better, having to say, yeah, I'm sorry too. And that's just one of these things, because I didn't delete that post. I sort of just left it out there. It's a reminder to me that how often, things can just go sideways.
Indeed. I mean, what's your take? Do you tend to get embroiled in internet debates with Christians or theists or any such?
Unfortunately, most of the time I seem to find myself fighting with other atheists. but there is clearly something about the internet which brings out kind of our worst natures. And it's similar to the way when you're in a car and people tend to get angry, and this phenomenon of road rage happens, I think, because of something called depersonification, whereby when you're in a car, you don't see the other cars as having people in them.
Right.
And I think something similar happens when you're on the internet. You are not relating to other people as we ordinarily do. And I don't know how that's going to affect us in the future. Because I do sometimes feel that I behave in a way that I'm ashamed of later on the internet. I might tweet something abruptly or put something up on Facebook and then immediately regret the impression that will create of
yes.
me.
Yes, because as you say, Randall, you can't read either sort of facial, people, it's very easy to misinterpret as well what people write on the internet, and tends to escalate things sometimes. And would you like to see more face-to-face stuff happening, Randall, between Christians and atheists? Obviously the internet is a very useful way of bringing those two together, but have we gone too far at one level?
In fact, the last chapter of my book, I talk about the need for hospitality, which in hospitality in a Christian sense traditionally meant not having good friends over for dinner, but inviting in the wayfarer, the stranger. And within this kind of context, that means inviting in, for example, for real serious interaction and dialogue and mutual exchange, people who are very different from you. And I think we need to do a whole lot more of that. I think that Christians, for example, should invite atheist groups to meet in their basement. I mean, often atheist groups are very poor. Right? They don't have a lot of money. And so then they want to get together monthly. Why a church could offer their basement space and then begin to build relationships with these people, not simply for the point of converting, but for the point of beginning to understand where people are coming from.
Yeah.
I think that's good advice for anyone, really. I think if we all approach our lives in a way that encourages us to engage with people unlike us, that's ultimately enriching for us. And so I think that's good advice in any context.
I mean, when it comes to the interpersonal interactions for you, Randall, I've had you on the show before, and obviously a lot of the time you're on the end of a line, and so's the other person maybe. So it's not like being face to face, but nonetheless, you're not you haven't been afraid to kind of disagree strongly with people. I mean, when I had you on with the friendly atheist, and his actual name's gone out of my head, Hemant Mehta.
Hemant.
You know, you came across, you said, you know, afterwards, well, he wasn't so friendly, was he? Because obviously you had quite a disagreement and so on. Now, so where do you draw the line? You know, are we allowed to kind of, you know, get a bit sort of, I don't know, not antagonistic, but sort of firm and call people out if you think they're putting out a straw man argument, or you feel they're just you know, messing around really when it comes to not taking your argument seriously or whatever it may be?
Well, yeah, so I mean, I think Hemant's a great guy, and I think one of the challenges in our interaction in that context, we were talking about the afterlife and heaven. I had this book on heaven, and the problem is he didn't think the position I had staked out was intellectually serious at all, that there was literally no evidence for it, that there's no real rational justification for a person taking it. And that can happen on both sides of an interaction like this. So if you have a Christian who comes to an atheist thinking, well, they're just in rebellion against God, they're suppressing their belief in God, then, you know, they're likely that's going to come through in their interaction, and they might be a little bit dismissive. And it can go the other way. If an atheist thinks that a Christian has no evidence for their belief, that they're simply want their security blanket of the afterlife, and that's all that this is about, then again, that might come into the interaction. I think that pointing that out in your interlocutors, pointing out where you think they're being dismissive and so on, there's value in it, but there is also a cost, because if you do begin to flag a person's inconsistency as you see it, or their dismissiveness, that can also heighten the tension, and you can perhaps lose them, you know. So it depends. You have to sort of...
And obviously there's a difference, in my view, between doing that in a pub where it's just the two of you having a good old chat over a beer, and doing it on a national radio station where maybe there's more at stake. You're kind of fighting for your position to an audience, and even more so perhaps if you're doing it on a stage in front of a live audience and so on. So I guess the context makes a difference as well, Randall?
Oh, yeah, very much so. Yeah, you're right. You have to... it's completely different if you're bantering over a beer in a pub versus on a debate stage or on national radio. So you always need to be thinking about, what am I going to accomplish by saying this or by responding in this way, and will that ultimately be helpful or not? And who am I speaking to? Am I speaking to win over this person, or am I speaking to win over people who are listening in? Because depending on what your aim is, that's going to change how you interact.
Indeed. I mean, you've said you don't have any real interest in doing those sort of public debates and so on, Elom. Is that because it does turn into a kind of can I win this argument type of affair?
I'm not sure what the point of those debates ever is. So I've done events where I've sat alongside Christians and Muslims, and we've all stood up and spoken to an audience and told our story or expressed our position.
And then had some kind of a Q&A afterwards?
Yeah, and then let the audience kind of probe us. But I think putting people on stage and getting them to fight, which is essentially what a debate is it kind of ultimately only serves the purpose of entertainment. I don't think there's many people attend such debates and then go away with their mind changed, for example. I don't think people go to debates of does God exist or whatever and walk out having had their minds changed. So to me, they seem like fruitless exercises.
Okay. I suspect you disagree a little bit here, Randall, without wanting to turn this into a debate, obviously.
I'm up for a debate.
Come on, we got to get some conflict going.
Absolutely,
here.
I need more drama, folks. No, but seriously, what you obviously do see a value in debates, Randall, because you have taken part in some, obviously. So, what's your perspective?
Yeah, so on the one hand, I guess so much depends on what our expectation is. I agree that if our expectation for the success of a debate is that people change their minds on one of the most fundamental questions one can ask, then you will likely be disappointed because people don't change their minds in the span of an hour and a half. But debates can be useful for presenting succinct statements of information to begin to move into understanding an issue. Now, I do debates because people like debates, but I have to agree in the most part with Alom here that I'm pretty ambivalent that sometimes debates can just perpetuate a sort of us versus them mentality. And people can just bring their confirmation biases into a debate and both sides come away thinking their guy won. So they can be counterproductive. What I've often wanted to do in debates is sort of subvert them a little bit. So, for example, as you know, I wrote a book with John Loftus, an atheist, and I wanted to debate him by having each of us in a public setting argue for the other side so that he would argue for Christianity and I would argue for atheism. Mm. And he wasn't interested in pursuing that idea.
It's a very counterintuitive idea, to be fair.
I wouldn't mind having a go at that. I think, as I've said before to Justin, I grew up in the UK, and whilst I was brought up as a Muslim, I'm also kind of was immersed in Christian culture, and I have a fondness for the Christian mythology, and especially having been a fan of C.S. Lewis. And I reckon I could have a good crack at pretending to be a Christian.
Well, look, hey, next week, Alom Shaha comes back as a Christian and atheist, and Randall Rouser joins us. But no, we're going to take a quick break, folks. Time's running away already, as it often does on this programme, and we'll come back for more discussion on whether Christians can count the atheist as their neighbour and vice versa, and about some of those sort of personal interactions that people have, and whether the online variety are helpful or a hindrance to good dialogue. That's what we're talking about on the programme today. Hope you can continue to join us here on Unbelievable, the show that aims to get you thinking, and find us online and have a debate about the latest show in the comments section as well. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories.
Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
Jesus had completed his earthly ministry by the relatively young age of 33. In the latest edition of the magazine, we profile 33, 33 and unders, following in his footsteps by doing fresh things for God in their youth. We also meet TV preacher Joyce Meyer to talk passion and prosperity. Plus, be inspired by the testimonies of ex-convict James and ex-drug addict Susie. All that and much more.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
And I'm Justin Brierley, presenter of the programme that helps to get you thinking every week here on Premier Christian Radio, also very popular as a podcast, listened to by people around the world. And it really is a community, I like to think of, Unbelievable, of Christians, non-Christians of various kinds, but coming together week by week to hear discussion and debate, sometimes of, you know, quite a... well, ardent type, let's say, where people really disagree. Sometimes, like today, where my guests have a great deal to share in common. And today we're talking about whether the atheist is my neighbour. How can Christians and atheists get along better? If you want to put your thought into the pot, then why not email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Send me an email. I'll try and read it out in a forthcoming edition of the programme. And we'll hear some of your comments to the last few weeks of shows towards the end of today's programme. You can also follow me at UnbelievableJB on Twitter, facebook.com/unbelievable. Unbelievable for the Facebook, and to let me know what you thought about today's programme and to see what we're doing generally across the week here on Unbelievable. Today's show available, of course, from the show website, and links to Alom and Randall, my guests on the programme today, from there. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Alom, what's your Twitter handle?
It's just at Alom Shaha.
At Alom Shaha. Very simple. And Randall, same for you, is it?
No, it's actually my name.
Oh, okay. You decided not to adopt Alom's name for your Twitter handle.
Yeah.
Okay. At Randall Rouser, in Randall's case. I mean, when it comes to Twitter, Randall, that's kind of the ultimate in kind of, you have to condense your thought into 140 characters or whatever. And whenever I get into a debate on Twitter with an atheist, it's very frustrating, because obviously you cannot do a proper theological, philosophical, historical or whatever debate in kind of 140 character sentences. It becomes very, boring after a while in many ways. And I just tend to find ourselves with going around the same thing again and again. Do you tend to engage in those kinds of Twitter sort of debates, Randall, or do you think they're of limited value?
Yeah, I think they certainly are of limited value. I think tweets are the bumper stickers of the digital age. in fact, one of the big things I give as an example in the book of this kind of rebellion thesis is a bumper sticker I saw in a car once that said, it said, April 1st is the atheist day. So April 1st is
normally April Fool's Day, yes.
Yeah, so that's the atheist day, because it's Psalm 14, 1 says, the fool has said in his heart there is no God. So in that would be a great tweet, right? Like, that would just convey in a succinct way the view that a person had, but it's a deeply alienating and tendentious or questionable, I think, interpretation of Psalm 14, and it doesn't lead to deeper understanding of other people. It just marginalizes them, and I think Twitter often does the same thing. So we really need to use those tools with caution.
Yes, and I know what you mean, that we're all in the habit, I think, well, we can get into the habit of kind of throwing out those things. I mean, going back to the issue of debates, one of the things I find most annoying very often on YouTube or elsewhere where I see it is that the 5-minute video titled Christopher Hitchens destroys so-and-so, or William Lane Craig rips to shreds such-and-such. And it's a 5-minute clip of one bit of a debate where you didn't see what the person said in reaction to it. And it just feels like, you know, I don't know, that for me is just frustrating, because you know you're only getting one side of the thing and whatever. There was something particularly you were interested in. You managed to read a little bit of the book. I gave it to you very short notice, along before you came on. But there was some one or two bits in the opening chapter that you thought were quite helpful.
I think Randall gives some really interesting examples of this attitude that some Christians have towards atheists. So the film God Is Not Dead, in which the main character is a kind of violent atheist, but the film ultimately explains away his atheism as him being angry that his mum died. And my mum died when I was a child, and I don't feel angry at God or the universe about that. But Randall also gives the example of the atheist shoe company whose shoes went missing when posted to America. And I just think those are kind of funny examples, but actually there's a serious thing at their heart.
Just describe this atheist shoe company, Randall, because I'm not sure I know this story. What was the deal with that?
So this is a company in Germany, and they have the German sentence, Ich bin atheist, on their soles of their shoes, so I am atheist.
Okay.
And when they ship shoes to North America, they would have atheist packing tape on the boxes. So it would say atheist on the outside. And then they discovered their shoes were disappearing in the mail in a disproportionately high percentage. So they tried an experiment where they sent some shoes with the packing tape that said atheist and other shoes in sort of a plain brown wrapper. And the ones that had the atheist packing tape were, I think it was 10 times as likely to disappear in the mail.
Wow.
So this suggests, and of course we can't know for sure, but it suggests there's somebody in the Postal Service who's maybe targeting packages that say atheist and sort of removing them from the system.
Yeah. Or really loves atheist shoes and wants to wear them all, I suppose. But
that's another possibility. You can't discount that.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's interesting, though, and it might be fair to say that there is a more of a divide in the US when it comes to how vigorous these two sides are. And it's not just a theological, philosophical debate there. It's often a political one as well going on, which isn't quite, you know, you just don't get quite the same thing here in the UK, I think. But is there any hope in the sense of, you know, I look on at the moment at the presidential sort of leadership debates and so on that are happening out there, and it just feels like it's all set up for antagonistic, you know, fights and debates, whether it's politics, atheism, Christianity, and so on, Randall. That seems to be the way, you know, it works very often in the States.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm a Canadian, so in some respects, culturally, we're midway between Britain and the U.S. But for me and for my culture, the practice of politicians invoking God for political gain and in debates, having commentators questioning them on their beliefs in God just seems to me like very strange and alien, and it's really disturbing. I mean, you have people like Donald Trump talking about their belief in God, and I have to say I wish he'd speak less about his belief in God and he'd do more demonstrating it in terms of courteous interaction with others.
Yes, I think I heard something about Donald Trump sort of did a pitch at a kind of Christian sort of conference thing, and was asked whether you know he had felt the need to be forgiven by God, and he said, "Well, I've not done anything wrong, so I don't think I need to be forgiven." Or worse than that. I guess some Christians might question exactly how a Christian Donald Trump's credentials are. But what about you, Alon, when it comes to when you do have those interactions and so on? Any kind of helpful things that you would say from an atheist perspective, if you're a Christian and you want to talk to me, are there any things that a Christian shouldn't do? Things that are going to wind you up, basically. Things that are going to kind of, you know, not help having a kind of helpful, fruitful kind of dialogue.
I think the classic thing is the same for me as in that film, God Is Not Dead. When people say to me that, you know, the reason why you're an atheist is because your mum died when you were a child and that somehow made you angry or whatever. I think that's very presumptuous. Mm-hmm. And it's rude to claim to understand my motivations better than I do myself. So I think that's the same for atheists as well. For atheists to presume that people believe in God, usually a lot of atheists are quite awful about this. They seem to think that people who believe in God are intellectually inferior, for example. And I think that's the most offensive thing you can suggest of people, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it's negative to hold assumptions about why people believe what they believe, and that if we're going to have these discussions, we shouldn't arrive at them with preconceptions about why people believe what they believe. Yeah. And we take it very personally when people challenge us about those things. And I think if you're going to have a meaningful discussion, then I'm not going to say you need to be open-minded to the extent that you might change your mind about God or whatever, but you need to be open-minded about where the other person is coming from. Mm. And to make judgments about that before you've had a chance to engage, I think is intellectually feeble.
Yeah. What then have produced kind of good conversations when I don't know, when you go down to the pub with Tom Price or whatever and have a good conversation, what is it that kind of makes you enjoy having that conversation rather than it feeling like this person's getting at me, this person's sort of misunderstanding me or whatever?
I think it's storytelling, really. I think weirdly, when I wrote my book, I originally wrote it as a very straightforward non-fiction book of arguments. Yeah. Around the issue of God, and then my agent said, look, you know, be a much more interesting book, a book that more people will be likely to pick up if you just told your own story. Mm. And I think that's how we can have better conversations, is if we take the time and trouble to listen to each other's stories. And I'm going to use this very popular buzzword of narrative, but I think people respond positively to storytelling. And for example, when I met Tom Price of the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics, I got to know him very quickly, actually, over the few hours that we spent together that first time. I got to know about his personal background. He told me how he came to believe in God. He'd been an atheist as a young man, and the experiences he'd had which led him to his Christian faith. And I found that fascinating, and I found I could relate to him as another human being.
Mm. Yeah. Randall, same question, but sort of the mirror for you. What's the most annoying thing that an atheist says to you when they are in a debate or discussion that kind of for you closes down or is very unhelpful to producing a good fruitful discussion?
I think that there are many uncharitable analogies that are often drawn between Christian belief or belief in God and various other things such as Santa Claus or invisible pink unicorns or fairies. Richard Dawkins, of course, is a chief offender here. So in the second edition of The God Delusion, he notes in the introduction that many people criticized him for his dismissive attitude toward theology, that he really has no background in theology, and yet he sort of lampoons it and treats theologians as absurd. And his response in that second edition was, well, I also don't know much about fairyology, but, you know, that's just as ridiculous. Those kinds of analogies, I mean, on the one hand, they simply show the ignorance of the person making the comparison, that they're comparing the work of, say, Thomas Aquinas or Bill Craig to somebody opining on fairies. They just don't understand the concept of God as a philosophical concept. But at a deeper level, it's also just very marginalizing, right? It just shuts down the conversation. Because how can you have a conversation with people who begin by thinking you're crazy?
Well, I know he's a common name that comes up, but obviously it's very easy to reach for examples with Dawkins. But a few years ago, there was a sort of reason rally in the States. And one of the things he said from the stage was, ridicule them and so on. He kind of encouraged at one level what is already sometimes going on in certain circles of the ridicule approach. But I've always felt that's a counterproductive, personally, if your role is to win people over, because you might have great arguments, but if you present them in a very condescending, snarky way, no one will listen to your arguments because they'll just think you're attacking them, I think, is my perspective on that. I don't know about you, Alon, but...
I think there's some research that shows that attacking people's views makes them cling on to them more strongly, and there's all kinds of... research around how best to communicate and how best to win people over. And I'm not convinced that those atheists who ridicule religion and so forth are effective in deconverting people from religion. But what I think they achieve, similarly to what kind of angry Christian types achieve with their ridiculing of atheists, is to bring together those people who feel their atheism very strongly as an identity. And it kind of perpetuates a type of tribalism and gives people a sense of superiority over the other, I think. And right. I think, you know, I'm not a psychologist and I'm reaching here, but I think that kind of approach isn't about converting people away from their religion. I think it's a little bit darker than that and appeals to a meaner instinct in people and saying, look, aren't we clever? Or can't we poke fun at these people together sort of thing? However, in Dawkins' defence, which some people who know me will find it funny that I'm saying this, I think what he's done through his work is allow more atheists to come forward and declare their atheism. And I think the new atheism movement has been positive, but I think we're already seeing, and we have been for some time now, a rejection of that kind of vindictive and approach.
Yeah.
And I think there is a movement within atheism to have a more thoughtful and humane approach to atheism.
Yeah, and it sounds like you're very much obviously in favour of that. I mean, having said that, I'm guessing you would still defend people's right, if they choose, to be able to ridicule religion and so on.
Absolutely.
As a matter of free speech, if you like.
Absolutely. I'm a kind of strong defender of free speech, and I think people should be allowed to ridicule everything. I don't think any idea is so sacred that we shouldn't be able to ridicule it. However, I think this kind of easy posting of things on Facebook to point out how stupid religious people are or whatever. And I don't know if Christians do the same thing about atheists. I think they do, actually.
They do. Let's own up to it.
I mean, we have to question what instinct is it that kind of thing is feeding? To me, it seems like it feeds a kind of meanness of spirit. And whether you're a Christian or an atheist, I don't think it's healthy to be doing such things. Maybe it's a way of venting or something. I don't know. But
I mean, I'm sure you're agreeing and nodding your head to a lot of this, Randall. But what's the answer to this? Because it's easy to sort of, you know, when you want to kind of create a bit of a discussion on Facebook, you know, posting that meme or whatever is the easy route to it. But it kind of always ends in the same old sort of, drawing up the drawbridges and throwing rocks at each other. So is there a way forward in sort of getting beyond that kind of a way that we've kind of grown a bit accustomed to these days online?
I want to begin by saying that there is a place for satire. So take the flying spaghetti monster. I mean, often it's just reduced to this trite trivializing image, but it comes out of an entire book that a fellow named Bobby Henderson wrote 10 years ago, which there actually is some pretty good stuff in there in terms of satirizing Christianity and or religion generally, theology and intelligent design. And it could be a conversation starter, and I don't think that we should take ourselves so seriously that we can't appreciate the satirization of aspects of our belief. Unfortunately, satire can often quickly move into just a sardonic marginalization that just sort of cuts people off. So I think we need to be ready to laugh at ourselves and have fun poked at ourselves. And I think that there's also a place in these conversations for self-deprecation. So for us, being willing to sort of treat ourselves in a way that is disarming to others, that we don't have to always defend our dignity and so on. We can take a joke, and we can even make a joke about our own foibles and limitations. I agree that for a person who doesn't come from a Christian plausibility structure, that when you begin talking about something like the Trinity, I mean, that looks kind of crazy. That does look like an invisible pink unicorn. So that's a starting point. I can understand where people are coming from. What I would just like to challenge them is to think that that's not the end of the conversation, that I do have a legitimate perspective, and you just need to invest the time to try to understand it.
I mean, what I sometimes find as well is that once you start a conversation, say online, it's so easy to, as it were, it's almost like you, like the politician who can never admit to having done anything wrong. It's almost like there's this inbuilt sort of nature to some of those debates where you can never give any ground, or you're seen as having lost the argument or whatever it is. And I wonder if that's part of the problem, is that we've have to some extent created a situation where it's about winning an argument, and that doesn't necessarily help the situation. I don't know if that's your experience, Randall.
Well, you know, Hilary Putnam, he's a famous philosopher, and he was famous. One of the things he's famous for is changing his views on things. And he took a lot of heat for that, a lot of criticism, and he had this nice, succinct rejoinder to it. He said, the job of the philosopher is not to adopt a view X and then become known as Dr. View X. The job of the philosopher is basically to follow the truth wherever he or she sees it to be. And I think that's exactly right, that changing your opinion on things or nuancing your opinion is not a sign of intellectual weakness. It's a sign of courage. It's a sign of independent thinking. You know, folks on the atheist side often like to adopt the term free thought to refer to their community. But I think the free thinker is the person, whatever belief community they're a part of, who can challenge their belief community even as they are a part of it. And that's where we really need to focus on encouraging free thought.
People like you are challenging their communities, and I hope that some of my work challenges my fellow atheists. And it's not about challenging them about their belief in God or whatever, but I think there are important challenges about how we behave in the public sphere and how we engage in these kinds of discussions. And I've been accused of being an accommodationist. Have you heard this term? Because I consider myself to be a genuinely friendly atheist. But I think so much of public discourse seems to center around people holding particular views and refusing to budge from them. And I think that's deeply unhealthy for society, actually. And this example you gave of Hillary, I think, is an example of someone who's genuinely open-minded. And I have to confess, I'm not a philosopher, and I once attended a one-day philosophy conference from which the only message I took away was that to be open-minded, to be genuinely open-minded, one must be capable of changing one's mind. And I think very few people are genuinely open-minded, regardless of whether they consider themselves Christians or free thinkers or whatever. And I think to test whether you are open-minded, what you need to do is look back at your history and see whether you've changed your mind about anything that matters deeply
right,
to you.
Yeah.
And if you can find examples of that, then I think you can claim to be open-minded. But if you're the kind of person that has held the same views throughout your life and never changed your mind, then you certainly can't claim to be open-minded.
That's an interesting way of looking at it. I mean, and a personal question here, Alon, but do you feel like you are that open-minded in as much as you could be persuaded?
Hey, I've told Tom, you know, and other Christians, I really like the idea of that God. I've often give this example to atheists. I say that what we as atheists and humanists have is the best thing we have is the love of our fellow human beings. I think that's love, whatever it is the most amazing thing that the universe has created. And imagine being how wonderful being loved and loving is. And then imagine being loved by a supernatural being, as the Christians claim.
The source of all love.
Right. And wouldn't that be wonderful?
It would. I believe it is. But yeah, wouldn't it be
You know, I would not be averse to experiencing that.
Sure.
And I see how a belief in God or a belief in Jesus as your saviour provides you with a kind of strength and support that I sometimes envy.
Right.
So, and I've tried talking to God,
right,
as Tom and others have suggested, and it doesn't work for me.
Okay.
I have to say that.
Yeah. But you've honestly tried. You've honestly sort of done the thing where you feel like a bit of an idiot, but you sort of
think,
I'm going to shoot a prayer up and see what happens.
Yeah, I've done that, and, you know, I'm a science teacher. I've done the experiment.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Unfortunately, the results have come back negative for me.
Okay.
But, you know, if I was to encounter something that made me change my mind, then I would change my mind, because that's how humans are.
That's interesting, because I do sometimes, I must confess, meet atheists for whom it does appear a bit like anything. There's almost nothing, no kind of evidence great enough or any experience veridical enough that would convince them.
But they're wrong. I tell you why they're wrong, because it's an illusion to think that you have any control over what you're going to be like in 5 years' time.
Right.
You know, all sorts of things.
Yeah,
I could get hit on the head, which somehow damages my brain in a way that makes me believe that I experience a religious phenomena, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I could go through personal experiences that transform me so much that I turn to God and believe that I found him, right?
Who knows?
So I think atheists who claim they would never believe in God are not being scientific, because there's plenty of evidence out there that humans
do change. Just quickly before we get to the end of this section, I'm going to ask the same question effectively of you, Randall. You know, could you conceive of a situation in which you changed your mind and you did become an atheist, having, you know, spent years and years defending theism and Christianity and so on? Could you imagine that?
Oh, sure, I can imagine that. I do think that we need to all recognize, and I know Alon has recognized this in his own process of deconversion or coming out as an atheist, that there are enormous social pressures for everyone to change their views on such a significant issue as this, particularly when they have tightly knit belief communities. And that's true of Christians, but it's also true of atheists. So Anthony Flew, for example, when he became a theist, he was a lifelong atheist, and he came out in 2003 and said he's now a theist. Based upon arguments, he was persuaded of the existence of God. He took enormous criticism online, a lot of people dismissing him as becoming feeble in old age and fearing death and so on. And those are social pressures that are not insignificant. So I think we all need to recognize the extent to which social pressures can continue to perpetuate particular sets of beliefs we have. And we need to take that into account as we try to assess honestly the evidence for or against our beliefs.
Well, we're talking about whether we can increase the quality of our discussions. I hope you enjoy the quality of the discussions here on Unbelievable, and that you've been enjoying today's discussion too. Randall Rouser, the author of Is the Atheist My Neighbour? Rethinking Christian Attitudes to Atheism. RandallRouser.com if you want more info. And Alom Shaha, author of The Young Atheist Handbook, still available, and you can find more of his writings at AlomShaha.com. They're my guests today on the programme that aims to get you thinking and brings you all kinds of variety of people and interesting discussions week to week here on Premier Christian Radio. All the links and more available from the show webpage, and you can even discuss it there as well underneath the most recent programme. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable. Come back in a short moment's time and we'll finish our discussion between Alom and Randall. Welcome back to the final part of today's Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. Don't forget that Unbelievable, Faith Explored generally, is brought to you in association with Premier Christianity magazine. I'm the senior editor there, and if you'd like to check out some of the recent blog posts and articles we've been posting, why not go along to the website, premierchristianity.com. See for yourself about some of the stuff we've been doing there, particularly around the issue of the refugee crisis in recent weeks and so on. There's also been some interesting talk, hasn't there, on social media and across the news feeds about this discovery of, I think it's called Homo naledi. This is what appears to be an ancestor of humans, evolutionary speaking, and some kind of new discovery in South Africa of a whole set of fossils showing the body plan of this particular form, humanoid form. But does it pose a problem for issues around theology, creation, and so on? James Preston said, "I can't wait to hear Unbelievable JB," that's the Twitter handle, "put together a podcast surrounding the Homo naledi discovery." And another person says, "I'm interested in how Christians will explain other human-like creatures burying their dead." All kinds of interesting questions, I think, that discovery raises. And I'll certainly be aiming to put something out within the next couple of weeks, actually, where we bring together a few different voices on this interesting discovery and what it says about biology, science, faith, and so on. Had quite the discussion last week on the future of China. Should it be atheist humanism or Christianity? That was between two people who still live and work in China. One of them, though, an ex-Christian, John Lombard, and one of them, continuing Christian, a Christian thinker and apologist, David Marshall. And they clashed quite significantly, actually, on last week's programme. And given that John Lombard's website is called Rest in Peace, it wasn't the most peaceful interaction. And it's continued, actually, online since in the comments section of the latest show. And if you want to look at that yourself, you'll see there's some 250 or more comments that have been going on underneath last week's show. And I'll try to read out a little smattering of some of the feedback and some of the points that John and David have continued to debate since that show was aired last week. So I'll read those out a little bit later on in today's show. If you can come back for Unbelievable next week, then you'll be able to hear a discussion on the resurrection. Ex-Christian Ed Atkinson is coming back into studio. He's revisiting the resurrection. That was one of the topics under discussion during our Summer of Scripture. Well, it sparked all kinds of questions in Ed's mind, and he's going to be grilling Canadian apologist Tony Costa about them next week. Tony regularly speaks on the evidence for the resurrection, employs the same methodology as Gary Habermas, who was here for our Summer of Scripture, does regarding the minimal facts hypothesis. So he's going to be talking to him about the empty tomb and other things. So look out for that at the same time next week. That's next week's debate. For the moment, time to get into the final part of today's show.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, welcome back to the final part of the show. Is the atheist my neighbour, we've been asking today. Randall Rouser and Alom Shaha, my guests. And it's been one of those shows where there's been a lot of mutuality, agreement, a good-natured discussion. And often, you know, we have far more divergent views, if you like, on the programme. I hope, though, that if you're listening this far, perhaps via the podcast or to the radio show, you've valued it because of that, and you're not just out for the dramatic interactions, you know, between well-known names who want to prove their point one way or the other. Personally, I think, you know, it's fun to listen to those. I have a smidgen of sympathy, though, definitely for your opinion, Elon, that you can sometimes get a lot more heat than light with those kinds of interactions. But it's been fun. We've had a lot of light today on the programme. Randall's book is The Atheist My Neighbour, asking whether we should be rethinking Christian attitudes towards atheism. You can find out more about it at his website, randallrouser.com. Elon, my atheist guest and author of The Young Atheist Handbook. And it's been lovely to get some of that reflection of what's happened in terms of your interactions with people like Tom since you were on the show a few years ago now, Elon. Before we start to wind things up, I think in your book, Randall, you also stress the importance of hospitality. So do you want to open that up a bit and explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, so I guess we touched on it briefly earlier, but it's the idea of, in this context, of really committing to listening to others and understanding where they're coming from. Hmm. I remember there's a section in a Henry Nouwen book where he talks about a graduate seminar where all the students, everyone just wants to share their opinion, and they meet the moment that other people start talking, they're trying to think of a rebuttal to kind of distinguish themselves over against the other people in the room. And as he points out, that's not hospitality. Hospitality is listening to others and trying to understand what they're saying and see where you could learn from it. And I think too often, when we have these deep divides and we listen to another person, we're always listening to them to the point or end of rebutting what they're saying. Mm-hmm. And so in the book, I tried to be very intentional about not doing that. When I invited Jeff Lauder to share in several pages his reasons as to why he's an atheist, I didn't offer any rebuttal in the book to them. I just let those stand because I think too often we're all about trying to get in the rebuttal. And if we do that, we really might miss something of what the other person is saying. So true hospitality would mean I'm not going to just look to rebut you. I'm going to try to understand in the strongest possible light what you're saying and then see where I could learn from it.
Yeah. I imagine you're sympathetic to that as well, Alon.
Yeah, as I've said, I don't engage in debates with theists. I've been invited. As soon as I wrote my book, I got a bunch of emails, mostly from Muslims, saying, you know, will you come to this university and debate this? And I got the impression that what they were looking for was an opportunity to take me down a peg or two, or to prove to their audience that they were superior. And I knew that all they wanted to do was attack me. And why would I go along to a place where people wanted to attack me? It didn't make any sense to me.
Do you find that in your interactions there is this temptation to not listen, to basically just, or the only reason you might be listening is so you can prepare your next rebuttal kind of thing?
No, so my interactions with theists of all stripes have mostly been through what I would call interfaith events and so forth, and I found it really fascinating to encounter the diversity of people who believe and the diversity of reasons why they believe and how they how they make sense of their lives and live as theists. So and I'm fascinated by people, and I've had really positive encounters with Christians particularly. You know, from a young age, I grew up on a housing estate where there was a church, St. Matthew's Church in the Elephant and Castle, and the priest or vicar, I'm not sure what the term is, a lovely chap who invited me over for dinner when my book was published, and then told me he'd bought two copies for his children because they were atheists, you know.
Yeah.
And we're both grown up and sensible enough to just accept that we make sense of the world in slightly different ways, but practically we live in the same world and we value the same things when it comes to things like hospitality and taking care of each other and how we wish to see society run. Oh. And I think that there's too much tribalism in the world at the moment, where we see so much around where we see so many examples of people trying to stake out their own territory and their own needs and so forth, when actually what we need to do is unite to overcome issues around poverty and sexism and homophobia and things like that.
Well, I mean, before we came into the studio today, you were sort of had a book with you and reading it, and we had a quick chat about it. And it's a book that's sort of introducing you to concepts of God in various parts of Africa and so on.
Yeah, it's called Foreign Gods, Inc., and the main character is a Nigerian, and it's about selling statues of gods. I'm not very far into it, but I think that it's always interesting to get an insight into how people who are very different from me make sense of the world, and to not become complacent in my own worldview. And
you said you don't want to just read male white authors who basically agree with exactly everything you agree with.
Absolutely. And my hope is that, you know, the more diverse the experiences, the literature, the art that I subject myself to, the more chance I'll have of stumbling across something that makes me look at the world in a different way. And that's why I'm an atheist. You know, I was brought up as a Muslim, but the things that I was exposed to as I was growing up, the education, the books and so forth, are what led me to atheism, where I'm very happy at the moment. Yeah. But, you know, who knows? I might stumble across other ideas, other ways of making sense of the world that suit me even better.
Well, it's been lovely to have you on the show, Alon. Thanks for coming on and sharing in such an open-hearted way. It's always a joy to have you on the programme. Randall, thanks for being on as well. Just quickly, if people haven't been persuaded already, why should a Christian or indeed an atheist go and buy your book?
Well, a Christian should go buy it because we are told to love our neighbour, and Jesus defines our neighbour, including the people that we don't want to interact with, like the Samaritan, of course. So I think Christian discipleship really requires us to get to know where other people are coming from and extend to them the same hospitality that God himself has extended to us.
Great stuff. And would an atheist get much out of it, or is this really specifically aimed at helping Christians to improve their relationships with atheists?
Well, I think that certainly this would help an atheist understand the degree of hostility that they would often encounter from the Christian community, sort of the theological and historical basis for it, and how they can rebut it. So in a sense, this book is an apology for atheists to become more equipped to point out the prejudices of Christians.
I think atheists should buy Randall's book, because I was very impressed at Randall taking to task other Christians for their attitudes. And I'm not sure if there's a similar book in the world of atheism.
Okay. Well, I'm sure there is, actually, because I do meet enough atheists who have problems with other brands of atheism and so on. But you do have to be a sort of person who's willing to not have too much of the island mentality or whatever to write that kind of a book. That's great that you've been able to do that, Randall. Thank you both for joining me on the programme. It's been really interesting. Hope you've enjoyed listening too. And if you want any more details about my guests, randallrouser.com, alomshaha.com, at Randall Rouser, at Alom Shaha for the Twitters, and all available, of course, from today's Unbelievable webpage. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable. And look forward to hearing what you had to say about today's show as well. And we'll be hearing some of your feedback in a moment's time to some previous editions of the programme. For the moment, Alom and Randall, thanks for being with me on the show today.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, if you're interested in getting in touch, you can do that by Twitter and Facebook at UnbelievableJB, the Twitter handle, if you'd like to send me a message and tell me what you thought of today's show, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB. And you can find the various links I post there through the week. You can find other interesting things, and you can, of course, leave me a message or leave me a comment underneath one of the links that I post. Also, a lot of people, as I've mentioned, who have been commenting after last week's show underneath the actual show on the Unbelievable webpage. You can find that at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, and you can also find the links there to all kinds of other material and the ways to get in touch. We'll read out some of your thoughts on that one in a moment's time. Cries Simonka got in touch though, and you may remember a couple of weeks ago I played out a couple of other unbelievable tunes that had been sent in by listeners, people who perhaps said, well, if you're looking for a new theme tune, Justin, for the programme, have you thought about this? And we had a couple of interesting ones. It sparked a cries to get in touch to say, I'm a listener to Unbelievable from the United States. I heard your segment regarding an updated theme song. I agree. A new theme song would go a long way. As a hobby, I'm an amateur musician. I composed the attached song called The Breakdown. I think the song applies, since many of the debates and conversations merely break down in terms of there being no official winner. The song is symphonic, yet modern and uplifting. You should give it a listen, and maybe could use the instrumental section from about the 2-minute mark. I could could imagine your voice over the instrumentation. You don't have to imagine, cries. I'm going to use it. I've decided I'll use it at the end of today's programme. So when I announce what's coming up on the next week's show, as I normally do at the end of Unbelievable, we'll use your instrumental bit from the breakdown and hear a bit of the song as well, I'm sure, in the process. So look out for that towards the end of the show. As I say, lots of feedback to last week's programme. This was The Future of China. Is it Atheist Humanism? Or is it Christianity? David Marshall and John Lombard really clashed on that one. And you'll see why when I read out some of their comments following the debate. But here's a few of what you had to say about it. This is one very short one from Fabian, who says, speaking as an ex-born-again atheist, I now accept Christianity as the way. Atheism is adolescence of the soul, which I myself experienced. Be interested in getting a fuller account of that from you, Fabian. A very short email, but let me know exactly what took you away from atheism. Here's one from, let me see, this is Ray. And he actually left this as well at the Unbelievable webpage, where there's that big debate going on underneath last week's show on China. He was replying to someone else's post, but he sent me it by email too, and said, I really don't think this is the answer. I can simultaneously answer both the Amsterdam Declaration of Humanism and this notion of spirituality with the same set of propositions. He says, firstly, the Amsterdam Declaration of Humanism displays a disdain for dogmatism, but both John and the Declaration itself seem unaware that they are indulging in dogma. This is not the main issue, I just note that in passing. Secondly, as the distinguished evolutionary philosopher Michael Ruse so perceptively and eloquently expressed, you cannot extract whatsoever the notion of morality from naturalism or mere energy. There is simply no foundation. It's an illusion. It's a non-realism. Thirdly, the whole notion of humanism is nonsensical given the Declaration's premise of naturalism and stated friendliness to evolution, because we inevitably become part of the food chain for some higher species. Let me expand on this a bit more because it's important. If one accepts naturalism as a fundamental premise, which I don't, then humanism is actually anti-progress. In this context, you'll have to say that the Sam Harris, Bart Ehrman charities are really hindering progress too. Think of this. Imagine an amoeba saying, let's all be friendly to amoebas. Don't let anyone of you all get the idea that one is better than the rest of us. As I said, it's as sensible as arguing for tapewormism. And if I may put it in stark terms, and I apologise for it, in X million years from now, you'll probably find human chops and fillet in the supermarket shelves according to naturalism. So where is the meaning of humanism in all that? And fourthly, says, the same applies to the energy argument. In X million years, you'll find human chops and fillet in the supermarket shelves according to naturalism and science and energy. So what does it mean to alleviate human suffering in this context? As I said, the Christian framework has far greater explanatory power. It tells you we are fearfully and wonderfully made, made in the image of God, and therefore have untold dignity and worth. So there you go. That's Ray railing against the idea that humanism offers some kind of free pass for humans to think of themselves as special in some way. If naturalism is true, that's simply not the case, says Ray. There were a number of interested parties as well. But we also had a number of people leaving their thoughts underneath the show, which is on the Premier Christian Radio webpage. Richard Lee said, hi Justin, great show. I came across it 1 year ago and have gone through most of the past episodes. Your show is a great help for me as a PhD student with interest in the sociology of religion and theology. I'm a Chinese national, so I think I may have the right to say something about Christianity in China from a Chinese Christian perspective. I was baptized in a free church when I was a master's student in the UK, but I do have a problem with charismatic worship, which led me to a local Anglican church. Since Anglicanism is introduced in Chinese as the Holy Catholic Church, which perfectly corresponded to my understanding of Christianity, especially the word Catholic, which convinced me that Christian faith is not a mere Western culture. But the problematic history and ecclesiology of the Church of England and its relativised moral social teaching often left me shorthanded when debating with non-traditional Christian sects like Mormons and JWs. Later, coming across the Nicene Creed, which states we believe in one holy Catholic and apostolic church, that became an aha moment for me, which finally led me to embrace the Catholic faith. I myself cannot believe that it would have gone that far, a journey to Catholicism. Many of my friends would think I'm out of my mind, or it really doesn't matter which denomination. What matters is you love Jesus and read the Bible. One thing I do thank my evangelical friends for is that they've taught me to love Holy Scripture. I have to say it's really dangerous for a mere Christian to love history, which is the starting point of my journey to Catholicism. But I need to say that Chinese Christians owe a lot of thanks to the modern modern Protestant missionaries. Go on to say that overall, my sentiment about Christianity in today's China is a bit complicated. On the one hand, I'm very happy to see that more people are abandoning their faith in communist ideology and embracing Christ. I thank God for that. On the other hand, I feel very uneasy to see that the truth of Christianity has been distorted by the radical divorce with Christian tradition and the problematic reformed doctrine of sola scriptura, which is likely to lead to the growth of fundamentalism and even dangerous sects and cults in the name of Christ, and lead to further state oppression of Christianity in general. A sign of this concern is the recent government clamping down on the growing movement of the house churches and the tightening of state-sanctioned churches. As far as I'm concerned, Christian faith is a universal truth, and Christianity has always been a public religion which stands for an upright moral voice in society and seeks to move society through charitable social services. But the very unhealthy social-political context has largely confined the social function of Christian churches in China. For example, in today's Chinese media, although there is an increasing appearance of religion, everything that has to do with Christianity is likely to be censored. There you go. Just a few thoughts from Richard and his thoughts on the state of Christianity out in China. Let's go to Peter, who left this comment underneath the show. After listening to the debate, I have the following questions with regards to the Humanist Manifesto or the Amsterdam Declaration. A, is it possible to find anyone who doesn't subscribe to the proposed values of the Humanist Manifesto? B, is there a better system than the Humanist Manifesto where an individual could aspire to more than what the Humanist Manifesto can achieve? And C, is it possible to find another way or system of accomplishing the outlines of the Humanist Manifesto? If the answer to any of the above is yes, then the Humanist Manifesto's proposed principles are neither objective nor binding. Furthermore, the above system will rely upon two factors, social and personal elements. In the case of social aspects, morality will be based on whether society approves or disapproves of it. On the personal front, morality will be based on whether a given individual feels his or her actions to be moral. So eventually we'll end up with a system that's non-binding, subjective and arbitrary. One last question, is there any country out there that is a signatory to the Humanist Manifesto or Amsterdam Declaration? Okay, let's go to some of the comments, though, that were left in the aftermath of that debate by the people who actually took part in the debate. John Lombard, the ex-Christian, and David Marshall, our apologist. And as I say, they clashed on the show, and they fell out even more dramatically afterwards when it comes to the postings that John put on his website criticising David and David's responses. David has responded fairly fully, actually, to a number of people on the comment section of The Unbelievable Show. If you want to read that in full, go there. But here's just a little bit of what John Lombard had to say in a post following the debate. David engaged in blatantly dishonest methods in presenting his arguments. Nor is this just a matter of opinion. I believe I can demonstrate beyond any reasonable doubt that this is a factual statement, regardless of one's particular opinions on the issues of morality. And you go on to say that I pointed specifically to the Amsterdam Declaration as the starting point that you wanted to use for your humanist beliefs, and stated my arguments regarding morality would be based on that specific statement of moral and ethical beliefs. Amazingly, but sadly predictably, David ignored this entirely. He jumped in headfirst by defining humanism according to what Chinese textbooks produced and published by communist government say about humanism. You went on to say later on in your post as well, John, in addition, David tried multiple times to argue that I don't have the right to define humanism for everyone. Well, of course I don't. However, I do have the fundamental right in a debate of this nature to define which specific moral and ethical system I am arguing for, and I try to do that over and over. Anyone listening to the debate can hear my rising frustration as David chooses to entirely ignore the position I'm arguing for. You go on to say later on in your post that you hesitate to call David himself dishonest. From his perspective, I do think he was presenting what he considers to be the truth. The problem is he's so invested in defending his own position, he's entirely unable to see the terrible inconsistencies in his own arguments. And you finish by saying, nor was this the only way in which David's arguments were dishonest. In regards to the issue of biblical morality, he also made arguments that were fundamentally dishonest and so logically flawed, it boggles my my mind that he seems to think they're reasonable. That's the topic for a separate post. Well, David responds to that and says, John has been posting follow-up thoughts to this debate and send me some emails complaining about my approach to two issues during the debate, especially how I see the Old Testament and the relationship between Marxism and secular humanism. I'm glad for the continuing challenge because it gives me the opportunity to clarify those important issues more thoroughly than I was able to at the time. So here are my two responses. John, I thought you were polite enough. I'd never expect perfect courtesy in such a forum because I didn't offer it either, for one thing. Sometimes I lacked patience to listen to a full argument before beginning my response, for instance. You were at one point kind enough to suggest that I'd be allowed to get a word in edgewise, which I was feeling the need at the point, frankly. Goes on to say here, I think one of your points is partially valid, the other one not at all. So where you are right is that I don't think I explained my view of the Old Testament well in response to your question. It seemed a little off topic, but I should have had a quick go. As I said, I'm not an inerrantist. I do think, however, that the Old Testament begins the trajectory of worldwide liberation that Jesus fulfilled and expounded in many profound ways. I wish I'd cited Dr. Donald Treadgold, former head of the History Department at the University of Washington, who wrote in Freedom, A History, Hebrew society was unique in the ancient Near East in managing to avoid the techniques, devices, and institutions of despotism. I often cite the prophets on this, including in my last book, While I wish I'd addressed this larger issue, I can't apologise for not answering a question about a verse that isn't in front of me and you neither quoted nor referenced. And frankly, I didn't recognise in the shape you referenced it on the spur of the moment on air. This would have been especially problematic because you seem to be assuming a view of scriptures that I don't hold. The position I lean toward is what philosopher Nicholas Walterstorff described as appropriated discourse. People who hold to that view, including my hero C.S. Lewis, need not feel panicky about hard verses in the Old Testament. Neither need they have an answer to every such attempt to force a believer into a choice between bad answers. Indeed, notice that Jesus himself was subject to that same sort of trick question. Jesus himself was asked if it was right to stone a woman who was caught in adultery, very much like the question you challenged me with about beating women. On the other question, I think I answered with sufficient clarity online. The issue between us is not whether democracy and various reforms are worthy objects. We agree on those. Indeed, I should have pointed out that many, maybe even most great reformers in modern East Asia have been actuated, at least in part, by their Christian beliefs. You say you're in favour of democratic reform. Fine, welcome to the club. Christianity has a long and illustrious history of instigating such reform, not only in East Asia, but around the world. So the desire for democratic reform isn't a variable between us and nothing to debate. It is a constant. Giving you as much credit here as possible, because as you admit, secular humanism, by your constrained definition, hasn't really achieved much in China yet. But the larger Enlightenment project, the broader humanism, as defined by Chinese themselves, has achieved a lot. So I think I was completely within my rights as seeing the real issue as being what Christianity in general, or humanism in general, can do for China, factoring out the constant on which we both seem to agree. Anyway, thank you very much for the responses, David, and for the other people who've been engaged in that debate. We're out of time, though, already, so we're going to have to leave it there and let you know what's coming up on the programme at the same time next week. Don't forget, you can email in your thoughts to anything you hear about the show, including the bits of feedback as well. unbelievable@premier.org.uk. But for now, I'm going to leave you with what's coming up next week on the programme and the music provided by Cries Simonka. This is the reason. Next week, we're revisiting the resurrection. Ex-Christian Ed Atkinson joins me. He's going to be in conversation with Canadian apologist Tony Costa. And they're going to be responding to where we left off, really, with that debate between Gary Habermas and James Crossley back in July, and what we know about the resurrection and the facts around it. And we're going to be debating that again. So look forward to that. Same time, same place next week. For the moment, thanks for listening to Unbelievable. The Profile is here next with Eric Delve. And thanks, Cries, for the music. Don't talk, this is never gonna stop. This is more than just a thought, this is called a